This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is Rebecca Buchanan, host of New Books Network, New Books in Popular Culture, and today I am here with Yael Levy, who is the author of Chick TV, Anti-Heroines and Time Unbound. So thanks for being here with me today.
Thank you so much, Rebecca, for having me. I'm excited.
So can you start by talking a little bit about how this book came about and how you started writing about Chick TV?
So actually, my interest in the intersection between feminist theories and television form and characterization has been it's a long time interest of mine. And already in my master's thesis, I was writing about characters of housewives and constructs of repetition. And then I realized that I wanted to kind of expand this project and talk about characterization of women in general and textual temporalities in general. So kind of looking at television form specifically in terms of its play with time and temporality. And the project was honing in on these two constructs, on temporality, textual and televisual temporality, and women characters. And then throughout my work, I realized that one of the most important things was the very hot discourse about complex TV. You know, the seminal, really fascinating book by Jason Mattel. And I realized that many of the examples used in terms of this discourse were about anti-heroes, namely men anti-heroes, and specifically in texts that I would call masculine texts, you know, that has kind of a masculine orientation in terms of genre, action-oriented or crime. And I know that today there's a lot more talk and research about women characters and specifically about anti-heroines, Isabel Pinedo and Hagelin and Silverman. And I have many names that I kind of recall throughout the book, but I really wanted to look at the beginning of the 21st century. The beginning of the 21st century in terms of what people have termed as the age of both anti-heroes and the age of complex temporality, of temporal play. And I wanted to go back to these years and show how quote-unquote feminine texts, that is, texts that are rooted in soap opera, that are about dialogue more than action, the domestic sphere more than the public sphere, women's issues, etc. These texts were often seen as inferior, and one of the You know, one of the arguments that not I'm making, many feminist scholars before me are making, that the inferiority perceived in these texts is often correlated with the fact that they're specifically oriented toward women or are considered women's texts or feminine quote-unquote texts. And so I kind of wanted to delve into these texts and show how these are complex in and of themselves. They have sometimes complexities in the text that are different from the narrative complexities of the masculine text, the so-called masculine text. And also that these complex characters of women, these anti-heroines, are also not less complex than the male characters that we can see in early 21st century, but that we need a kind of a different hermeneutics to look into these characters because their complexities or anti-heroinisms, as I call them, sometimes appear differently than they do with men characters. And so the main issue is that if anti-heroes are kind of play with our alignment, that they're the protagonists and we identify with them, but then they kind of push back against identification, usually through moral ambiguity. But the thing is that when you look into these pushbacks, many of them are resistances to gender constructs. I mean, these are men who are not necessarily family oriented, who are not necessarily protectors or the moral heroes that you would expect a protagonist to be. And so in this sense, I find that many early 21st century anti-heroines kind of push back against gender constructs as women, that they're not nurturers or they're not mothers, they're not sexually objectified as they should, quote unquote, should be, etc. So I wanted to look at this intersection between the resistance in characterization, namely women characters who resist these patriarchal limitations, who go against the social order, and the resistance of the texts who resist linearity or progressivity and what Elizabeth Freeman coined as chrononormativity. They're not normative in terms of their temporality. So they play with temporality. They go back, they stall, they expand. And so these two forms of resistance, characterizational resistance and temporal resistance, kind of went together in my research of chick TV, because I talked about chick TV as this subgenre of, you know, the continuation of chick lit and chick flicks, kind of texts that are oriented toward women, again, more minded and focused on dialogue and women's issues and family and romance, etc. But not to look at them only as kind of the guilty pleasure fluff that culture usually looks at them as, but more looking into the complexities that they might suggest. Again, both in terms of their structures and in terms of their characterizations. So I think that was kind of my interest in going into these constructs that are very much in the discourse and looking at them from a feminist perspective.
And can you talk a little bit, before we like really get into the heart of the text, can you talk a little bit about those, what shows you chose and maybe why, right? Why you chose the ones you did?
Yes, thanks for that. So yeah, obviously I have many shows and using that category of chick TV is quite wide. And, you know, I have specifics in terms of mainly themes and narrative construction, but I wanted to look at different texts in terms of not only generic tendencies, but also how they're built. So that would be both texts that are from the very beginning of the 21st century. I think my first text is Six Feet Under, which started in 2001. But Six Feet Under is, I I look at it as a chick TV because it's very family oriented, and the women characters are very elaborate, and we have a lot of discussion of family and sexuality and the domestic sphere. But of course, we have also men's characters, and there's a debate whether the actual protagonist is the white man or not. But it's often been seen as a quality TV show. And so I wanted to look at it as a not necessarily inferior text in terms of the discourse, but why the fact that it does kind of direct itself towards chick TV orientation has its own complexities that are different from its complex TV narrative that is related with its masculinities of the text. So, and also it's an ensemble show, it's a quality show, which it's HBO, it's very early 21st century. So that's kind of its own category. And then the next would be Desperate Housewives, which started in 2004. And it's more, I think people would feel more comfortable with kind of terming it chick TV because it's very soapy in its orientation. And the women are definitely the protagonists. We have an ensemble of women who are the main characters. And also the fact that, again, it's an ensemble, but only of women. I mean, the men characters are more marginal. They're minor in this text. And also kind of the play with the subgenre of, you know, noir TV or suspense. So it kind of plays with that. Then I have Grey's Anatomy, which is also very soapy. It started in 2005. And again, here we have an ensemble, but also kind of a both men and women ensemble. And it's interesting in terms of genre because it's a hospital show. So initially, medical dramas were considered more masculine television, but we can see how in over the years they've been kind of intersected with soaps, and we have narratives that kind of play. Specifically in Grey's Anatomy, you don't see the domestic sphere very often, but there's very clear demystification, I would say, of the workplace. It becomes kind of a family workplace, the romances, it seems as if there's sibling rivalry sometimes. It's very a family kind of relationship in the workplace. And then I also discuss reality TV, specifically docu-soaps. So in terms of chronology, the next text would be The Real Housewives, which started in 2006. It's a huge franchise, of course. There are various branches to this franchise. And I discuss many of them when I talk about seriality, but also it's very soapy, very chick TV in terms of its orientation, women in the forefront, discussions of children and family and sexuality and women's desires, and it's very aspirational. So I think you can see already that there's similarities and differences to the texts. Then I discuss Nurse Jackie from 2009. I think she would be the most directly discussed as an anti-heroine because she's also kind of dabbling in moral ambiguity. But interestingly, this is a single protagonist-led chick TV text. We have Nurse Jackie in the front. She's the protagonist, and the rest of the cast kind of organizes around her narrative. And Sister Wives from 2010 onward, which is also a docu-soap, women ensemble, a polygamist family, and the women, even though the man is kind of very, his decisions rule, and there's a very patriarchal organization of the text, the women are very dominant, their decisions, their lives, their issues, their desires, etc. And then Girls from 2012, which is also, I think, I would debate whether it's a single protagonist led or an ensemble, but the girlish issues are very much in the front. And then lastly, from 2013, Being Mary Jane, which is also a single protagonist led drama. And the life of the protagonist, Mary Jane herself, is very much in the forefront. Her conflicts regarding work and life matters. I didn't discuss this, but in some of the shows that I chose, also kind of racial and ethnic issues come about. And in Being Mary Jane, it's very dominant because Mary Jane herself is an African American woman, so her conflicts with her, the way that she's constructed by society as an African American woman who is very talented in what she does, her romantic conflicts, her conflicts with her family. So all these are kind of very important to the way that the text is constructed, both as, again, a feminine text, a chick TV text, and in terms of the protagonist herself, as she is the protagonist in terms of identification and alignment of viewers, but she pushes back against easy identification. This is a quote by Emily Nussbaum, by the way, when she talked about anti-heroines, she discusses how they push back against easy identification. So Mary Jane does just that when she's kind of playing with her role as a single woman. There's infidelity, there's conflicts again with the family. So all the texts that I chose are texts that have chick TV orientation in terms of genre and narrative, are important in terms of the way that women characters are in the front, they're foregrounded, their issues and interests and desires are the most dominant in the texts. And I also kind of wanted to have, again, both a variety in terms of the years in which these series have started. So you can see that I kind of go for the first decade and a half of the 21st century to kind of look at the beginning, but also shows from different years within this decade and a half, and that have kind of, even though they're all chick when I look at them, they have different hybrids of other genres to kind of look at how this works in terms of genre, in terms of narrative constructs, etc.
So you've divided your book into four chapters that get at some of what you've talked about already, but I'd love to delve a little bit deeper into those areas. So the first is resistance. And so could you talk a little bit about that chapter, what you're trying to do in that, and what you kind of, you've talked about it a little, but a little more about the idea of resistance.
Yes, thanks. So resistance, I think the fact that it's kind of the first chapter bears the name resistance, the title resistance, is both the due to the fact that resistance is in many ways what kind of drives the book itself, because everything I discuss is about feminist resistance and narrative resistance. So the first chapter kind of tries to look into this intersection of narrative resistance and feminist resistance. And the way that I do it in the first chapter is kind of, I go into, I would say, the sub-episodic layer of the TV series that I chose. So I look at kind of literary devices that break the narrative and delay it. I look at, for example, story within story, reverie and fantasy. And in the docu-soap genre, I look at confessionals that kind of delay the progression of the narrative and work into it this kind of sometimes indirect resistance. It's resistance, first of all, because of the fact that it delays the narrative. It kind of sidesteps the narrative for a second to say something about the narrative. If it's a story within story, it's kind of the way that the story within story as a sub-episodic unit kind of play with the framework of what it's integrated into. It's an intradiegetic unit that kind of says something about the story as a whole. And the same goes for reverie and fantasy. So I wanted to look at these units in terms of what they say, both, again, about the narrative and about the character. Because my argument in this chapter is that what happens in these sub-episodic, intradiegetic units is that there's an anti-heroinization of the character. These are the moments that there's something exposed about the character, about the woman character, which in the chapter I discuss how it's different from examples about men characters, that says something about the story that goes against the story sometimes. It kind of pushes back against the identification that the protagonist deserves in a sense. Whereas sometimes we see in men's texts that these intra-diegetic units mostly work to fill in gaps, to kind of add into the story that is already going on in the framework of the narrative. So they kind of add to it or make it, you know, more expansive or more coherent. Whereas in the women's stories that I look at in the 21st century chick TV texts, they're often kind of combated with the enveloping narrative kind of around these intradiegetic moments. So this is, again, the first unit that I think exemplifies how these two things collide, how feminist characterization and resistance in the anti-heroine works with the feminist narrative. Even if this feminist resistance in the narrative, in the temporal delay, in the temporal resistance, it could be indirect. It could be hidden and subtextual. But when I look into, I do this close reading of these units, I see the kind of through, I would say, the cracks of the text. You see these resistances that kind of restructure how you see the character and kind of anti-heroinize her in a sense.
Yeah, you throughout this, right, as you talked about, you did it in different ways. But so like one example is, for me, I thought was really interesting was 6 Feet Under and really thinking about the fantasies, the men's fantasies versus the women's fantasies, and how the men's fantasies were more those serious topics, right? But that did not make the women's fantasies that had to do with more relationship and family any less serious or important, even though we value it that way.
Yeah, this is going back to Virginia Woolf. She talked about how men's stories about war are considered superior to women's stories about family and talk, for example, right? So this inferiority of women's texts, of course, I in many ways I would like to kind of orient my text in the tradition of many feminist writers who kind of took these women's texts that are considered inferior and showed how they're complex in and of themselves. I'm talking about melodramas and women's romance and, of course, soap operas, right, from Annette Kuhn and Tanya Modleski and many other feminist writers who kind of discussed the fact that the mere inferiority perceived in culture for these texts is in and of itself, I would say, misogynistic, right? Because it kind of makes the fact that it's about women to be inferior. And so these feminist scholars looked into these texts to find the complexities within them and show how they might be different from what we perceive as superior or, as you said, serious, right? From what is perceived differently, but not necessarily less complex. So my example in 6 Feet Under is to show that even these fantasies of Ruth, the mother, for example, who's a housewife and she sees her house differently in her dreams, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's not political, right? That the fact that sometimes culture tries to depoliticize these issues as fluff or as mundane doesn't necessarily make it so. And I think that the fact that the political issues with men's characters and their conflicts within themselves are much more outwardly shown in, for example, 6 Feet Under, right? We have a character who struggles with his homosexuality versus his Christianity, or a man character who struggles with his desire for connection versus his desire for freedom and self-reliance. And many of the conflicts of these women, of course, all the characters in these shows have their conflicts kind of manifested in their dreams and in these fantastic scenes in which they converse with the dead, etc. But the women's fantasies or reveries or talks with the deceased people often kind of politicize the more hidden or subtextual conflicts that are shown in the text itself. They kind of, they force them to meet them rather than go with the conflicts that are already presented in the text, as we often see with the men's issues. I hope that was clear.
Yes, completely right. And it sort of leads into that your second chapter, right? Deviation, which I found really fascinating at looking at not only flashbacks and flash forwards, but that flash sideways, right? Those ideas of how they do play with time or freeze time. So could you talk a bit about that and what's going on in that chapter and those ideas of time and watching.
I would use this opportunity to kind of, I'm not sure that I said this before, but the way that the chapters are built is via these temporal layers. So the first one is resistance in the subepisodic layer. And then deviation, as you mentioned, kind of focuses on the episodes themselves, what happens in the episodes, not in the subepisodic level. So I talk, as you mentioned, about flashbacks and flash forwards and flash sideways. And then in the next chapters, in chapter 3 and 4, I talk about serialization, the resistance of the serial form as a whole. And then in chapter 4, about intertextual repetition. So it goes from the subepisodic to the episodic to the intratextual to the intertextual. So this is how I kind of look at these resistances and the intersection again between characters and form. And so to go into the second chapter, deviation, I titled deviation because if the first example, the intradiegetic literary devices resist and then the text could just go on, with the example of deviation with flashbacks and flash forwards, I kind of suggest resistance that deviates from the trajectory of the original text. So what I do in this chapter is I look at examples. My main kind of study case is Grey's Anatomy, and I look at chapters that are dominantly constructed around flashbacks and flash forwards and flash sideways. And I kind of try to show how from these moments on, the characters that undergo these flashbacks or flash forwards or sideways are in many ways anti-heroinized more so than they are before them. So these temporal deviations work to characterize these women. So you wanted me to focus more on the flash sideways. So I focus specifically on this episode that goes sideways. And interestingly enough, in Grey's Anatomy, what happens in this episode is that if I address like these a few main women characters from the series who are in a sense anti-heroines, each in her own way, they kind of, at least in the conscious way, right? In the reflexive way that they discuss their anti-heroinism, their resistances. Some of them are not into going into feminine performance in terms of family. Some are not interested in going into feminine performance in terms of sexuality or work, et cetera, et cetera. And then what happens in the Flash Sideways episode is that they move from anti-heroinism into either heroinism or villainousness. So again, one of the arguments of the book is that many times that women exhibit anti-heroic characteristics, they're deemed as villainesses rather than anti-heroines. And so what happens in this episode is that Meredith, the protagonist, for example, becomes this so-called heroine, as she is very reminiscent, I would say, even of 1950s sitcom a housewife mother characters. Even in terms of performance, she starts wearing pink cardigans and her hair looks differently and she's very demure. And Christina, for example, is villainized. She becomes this misanthropic, hated person who she has these kind of touches of this characterization in the series itself, but these are expanded and become much more dominant in the episode. And then I show how the temporal resistances of the Flash sideways work to kind of bring them back into anti-heroism through their meeting each other, the heroine and the villainess, kind of anti-heroinize each other via the way the text is constructed, via the Flash sideways, the kind of plays with their characterization. And again, the men characters in the Flash sideways undergo very different characterization changes, right? They don't move specifically in terms of character, even if they hide the characters that they really are. But the women really undergo changes. They kind of pinpoint and emphasize their anti-heroinisms that persist after this episode, even more so than they did before it.
Yeah, and so from that, right, so you look at those flash forwards, flash sideways in these real, in the scripted television, and then you move into what I find one of the most fascinating reality television franchises that we have had, right, that's still going strong, and right, is The Real Housewives and that idea of serialization. So could you, let's start with the idea of serialization and then we can talk about The Real Housewives.
I just want to say that I completely agree. It's fascinating, going strong, and that's what led me. I started with this franchise because I was fascinated, and also this writing about this franchise, because I think that many scholars are fascinated by its popularity, but also by the way that it's constructed. I mean, I think that, again, in terms of my presumption in the book, is to kind of say the fact that these texts are so popular among women must mean something other than the fact that they're fluffy. I mean, they must have some complexities. They must have something that draws identification and complexities. And I think that many scholars before me have written about this. And my interest in this franchise was to kind of use it as a main study case in the chapter because it has a very fascinating form. It's a reality franchise. And nowadays we have, I mean, franchise, of course, we see in movies, in scripted television, right, from CSI and NCIS, but also after Real Housewives, we've seen Million Dollar Listings and Basketball Wives. We have several, but this is by far the largest, most expansive franchise in reality TV. And again, extremely popular. And my interest in it was to kind of look at the serial form of this text because it's, in a sense, serialized serialization. Because each installment has its own progression, but the franchise as a whole, and this is mainly what I did in this chapter, the franchise as a whole has these interconnections between the episodes. And what I looked at was the way that they were aired, which I know that today we have streaming and many people don't watch when the episodes are aired. But it was very interesting to me because I think that this franchise is a world in and of itself, right? We have talk shows that discuss these women at the same time what happened in yesterday's episode and what happened yesterday in, I don't know, Luann de Lesseps' life yesterday. So in many ways, the diegetic and the extra-diegetic converge in this series. And not only do they converge, they also kind of necessitate on-time viewing. Because if you delay viewing, you might not be in the know of the gossip of this expansive franchise. So I do think that in terms of this series, linear viewing is still part of the experience. But also I wanted to discuss the text itself to kind of see how it's configured in broadcasting and how the way that the text is dispersed affects both themes and characterization. So what I did in this chapter was I looked at the ties between episodes that were aired over the same week from different installments. And what I wanted to show was that in some ways similar to what this the story within story, for example, does, that these episodes complete each other. I started with the first example when The Real Housewives became a franchise rather than a monolithic series was when the first installment, The Real Housewives of Orange County, became a part of both Orange County and New York City. So the first time that they aired was the preview special of New York City was immediately after The Real Housewives of Orange County. So they were aired one after the other as if they're part of the same text, which in many ways they are because they're aired on the same channel, produced by the same company. They have a similar mise-en-scène and narrative design. And of course, the plot premise of these highly aspirational bourgeois women, more or less in urban environments when it comes to Orange County, but they're urbanized in terms of their, again, they're aspirational and they have these socialite tendencies. And so there are similarities between the texts, but of course they don't really interconnect in terms of the narrative because these women are not part of the same cast. They're not part of the same ensemble. So the Orange County episode ended trying to kind of tie in what happened in the episode and bring the season into a close. And then it restarted the narrative with the New York City preview special with new women, with new characters. And here I draw on Tanya Modleski's writing about soap operas when she shows that soap operas are built to never answer questions, but more always kind of introduce new questions into the text and stretch the temporal narrative. And she showed how this stretching is resistant in and of itself in terms of its feminist resistance because it resists order, it resists resolution. And here I wanted to show how this resistance comes about in the serial form, in this franchise as a whole, how the way that the franchise as a whole is constructed and configured works in a form of characterizational resistance and narrative resistance, which is not necessarily seen in each of the installments by itself. So I, in a sense, I wanted to show how this serialized seriality or this intratextual connection between the installments also works to anti-heroinize these women characters in the Real Housewives franchise.
No, I mean, I found it really fascinating when you were talking about it there, that idea that they would air like three shows, you know, it used to be, you know, then it'd be this show and then this show and this show. And just thinking about that and, you know, and thinking about also how they use location and, you know, many are focused on East and West Coast, but there is also some Middle America, and thinking about where these women sort of live and exist and how that kind of plays out into creating a larger kind of narrative and storyline throughout.
Yes, and of course, these differences, which I think you're right in terms of the locale and the spatiality of how these installments are designed is very important to the differences between them, right? So there are many similarities, but the difference is, I think, the most important difference would be the locale and the way that these women have their relationships with the places where they live, whether it's more or less urban, whether it's more or less coastal, as you say. And of course, we have also racial differences between the installments that are also kind of connected to where these women live. And these differences play into one another. We have the white installments, and then we have other installments who are kind of have more dominant women of color in them. For example, of course, Atlanta is mostly Black women. So the way that you see Atlanta episodes aired on the same week as Beverly Hills episodes plays into how motherhood is architectured in these episodes, and how women's friendship is, and how anger is. You know, I discuss a lot anger in this episode as kind of a form of anti-heroinism. These women that resist the need to be ladylike or demure or silent in how they express their anger. And you see how these episodes kind of back each other, episodes that were aired in the same week, that in many ways allows women to express their anger, right? So these commonalities work with these differences to kind of have each installment contribute to the way that the other is more resistant, both in terms of characterization and in terms of structure and narrative.
And so your fourth chapter, your final chapter, is on the idea of rewriting and what that looks like. So could you talk a bit about the idea of rewriting, and then we can talk a bit about, well, Desperate Housewives?
Yes, of course. Thank you. So the fourth episode is kind of, if I had subtextual or sub-episodic and then episodic temporality and then serial temporality, the fourth kind of goes out of the serial form to look at intertextual temporality. And I discuss repetitions between chick TV texts and between anti-heroines and chick TV texts. And I titled the chapter Rewriting because I wanted to offer that if the first chapter delays progression, and then the second deviates from it, and the third kind of serializes it in terms of serializing performances and misperformances of femininity, and kind of the resistance is a series in and of itself. So this repetition between intertexts of anti-heroines in chick TV kind of works to rewrite the time of history, to use Julia Kristeva's term, the time of history, which is a masculine, progressive, you know, beginning and ending kind of temporality. And the system of resisting repetitions of chick TV and anti-heroines accumulates and becomes as bolstered into this, I would say, like an army of chick TV anti-heroines that together, when I read through them together, they have this kind of force to take all these forms of resistances into this new order, this chick TV alternative order in which complexity looks a bit different and anti-heroinism looks a bit different. And not only that, the anti-heroines that look like the men anti-heroines that are morally ambiguous, self-reliant, misanthropic haters, but also a nurse or a housewife whose resistances can be subtextual or intratextual, but when read together, they have this kind of force to offer a form of resistance that was maybe not as conspicuous when we looked at these texts in early 21st century. But when I look at them together, I see this kind of bulk of texts that offer a feminist resistance, again, through characterization and narrative.
And you sort of, you alluded to it, but one of the things in this chapter that you really look at is sort of how sex and sexuality and sort of sexual prowess plays out in these texts. And I'm really thinking about, right, and how that the married woman who is having, you know, extramarital affairs versus the single woman who is sleeping with men who are having extramarital affairs. So can you talk a little bit about how that kind of plays out and how what you see is important about really examining that and looking at that?
Yes. So I didn't mention this, but I look at the anti-heroines in the text through four continua. I address the domestic or familial continuum and the sexual continuum, right, from the Madonna whore dichotomy, where women are supposed to be family oriented and domesticated, but sexual in terms of providing for family, but not necessarily have a sexual subjectivity. And I have these two minor continua, the intellectual continuum and the class continuum, that I'd say are not necessarily feminine performance related, but they work to police the other two. So in the fourth chapter, when I address intertextuality and rewriting, I look at women who are overacting, or they have an over-exemplifying of sexuality or domesticity. And so in the example that you discussed in sexuality, I look at women who try to articulate their sexual desires, but don't want, and when I say they don't want, I also mean that the texts don't want, right? It's not necessarily also only the volition of the character itself, but also the way that the text forms this volition. So these women or these texts, they want to express sexual subjectivity of women without, on the one hand, hypersexualizing them and turning them into these Jezebels or the horrors of the Madonna whore dichotomy, but at the same time, not silencing their sexuality, which is often something that has happened in the history of women characters in television, that they were either prowess or silenced. And so what happens in these 21st century texts, television texts, is that you often see a kind of reflexive intertextuality. These texts that are aware of how women's sexuality is designed. And the example that you discussed in Desperate Housewives, I show how we have the hypersexualized women. She's also incidentally, of course not incidentally, she is also the villainess. Because and part of characterizing her as a villainess is to show how sexually, I would say, quote unquote, promiscuous she is. And then we have the heroine who is the perfect housewife. And part of the fact that she's a heroine is to show how the only expression of sexuality for her is when it's oriented toward family and toward her monogamous partner. Edie is the villainess and Susan is a heroine because she direct all her sexuality toward family and monogamy. And then Gabrielle, the character of a semi-housewife, she's a housewife because she doesn't have a job in the public sphere, but she is very resistant of any domesticity or housewifery characterization. And she doesn't want kids at the beginning of the series. And again, part of this ambiguity is also manifested in her sexuality, because on the one hand, she loves her partner and she's a sexual subject. But then on the other hand, she feels frustrated from her marriage and she starts an affair outside her marriage. And then I wanted to show how the fact that Gabrielle has this affair, and despite the fact that she practices infidelity, if you will, identification with her character is not damaged. It becomes more complex, even, and the way that the text constructs it, as it kind of gives her focalization and justification for how she feels, but also kind of punishes her when her affair is found out. So there's this complexity that kind of works between these. On the one hand, the text is very conservative in terms of the heroine versus the villainess. She is sexually, quote unquote, promiscuous, and the other is sexually demure and reserved and not excessive in a sense. But then there's Gabby. There's this character of Gabrielle, and she is anti-heroinized through intertextualizing with these two other characters, but also through intertextualizing with characters of both the past who were punished for their sexuality, and also characters of texts that are released at the same time. Other 21st century texts that address sexuality, such as Six Feet Under, who is very reflexive about the way that the sexual subjectivity of its women characters is constructed. And these, and again, here I talk about how intertextuality is part of what anti-heroinizes these women characters whose sexuality is neither, you know, perfect and only family oriented or excessive and over sexual characterization of these women.
So throughout your book, right, so you're looking at these areas and all of this, and so what you get to this conclusion, and so it's this idea of reclaiming this idea of chick for TV, right? That's sort of your that, you know, what you call your conclusion. And so could you talk a little bit about that? Like, why is this? And you know, you've talked throughout, but like, what is it after looking at these, after thinking about these texts, why do we need to really care about this, right? You know, what, I mean, I know why,
but you know what? No, you're right. I agree, because I think that what I'm trying to say in the conclusion is, as you said, in many ways, this is something that I discuss throughout the book, but I think that why we need to care about this, it's a fantastic question, because I think that why we need to care about it is, again, to look at how social categorization of culture sometimes becomes cemented. And we need to kind of defamiliarize the way that these categories are set, to look into them again and look into their complexities and not miss out on things that are considered inferior or guilty pleasures as, again, as just fluff. Because I think that my project in this book is, again, to do what many other important feminist scholars before me have done in talking about soap operas and melodramas and women's novels and chick flicks and chick lit, in showing that these cultural categories are not to be looked at only as inferior because of their relation to femininity and to women's audiences or women's issues or women's desires, that very often these correlations are what make them seem as such, whereas the texts themselves can be elaborate and complex and offer resistances. And even more so than that, more often than not, they can have complexities that are much more interesting than texts that are considered quality directly, because they sometimes hide these complexities within the creases of the text. Again, as melodrama scholars have shown, that the mise-en-scène sometimes shows something about the emotion that cannot be addressed in the dialogue in a direct way. And so what I wanted to show in this book is, again, the creases within the text, and the creases that I focus on the temporal creases. The temporal textuality of these Chick TV texts is complex, and it's fascinating, and most importantly, it's political, because it works to, again, position women's culture as important and interesting, and also to resist the social order in many ways, some more hidden and other more explicit, and to kind of offer this other order, this other narrative order, this other televisual order, other forms of characters, other forms of anti-heroics that are not necessarily constructed exactly the same way as the anti-heroines, as the anti-heroes of 21st century, such as, you know, the white men, Tony Sopranos and Dexters and et cetera. So these women offer something different, but it's not necessarily less anti-heroic or resistant or complex. It just looks differently. And we need to kind of wear these different glasses to look at them. And so that's why I think it's important.
No, perfect. Like, so, you know, is the book out yet, or is it coming out?
It keeps on being postponed. I don't know. It was supposed to be out in the summer. And I'm guessing, I mean, you know, we had these crazy 2 years, so I'm guessing everything is backlogged. And then it was supposed to be in December. And now I think they're saying probably February. So I'm really hoping it would be out soon. I think it's very timely, and I would be very happy to kind of keep discussing it and have more and more people have the actual text in hand. Mm-hmm. But right, hopefully so soon.
So usually my final question is if there's anything else you're working on now or any, you know, but I'm guessing too, you're working on what you're going to do when this comes out, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know if there's any last thing you are, you know, looking at or looking into or anything even with this book that you want to kind of promote or put out there.
So I think my obsession with this tie between characterization and form kind of keeps accompanying me. And right after I finished and I sent the final revision of the book, I realized that Insecure had just started, and I really wanted to talk about this text that I found fascinating, specifically in terms, by the way, of sexuality that we just addressed. So I have a piece about Insecure, and this kind of threw me again into talking about the ties between authorship and performance, which I'm interested in writing a text about now. And I'm hoping to kind of expand on these relationships between characters and form, kind of try to dive into television form and characterization in many ways and forms and perspectives as I can.
Great. Well, it's been great talking with you again. This is Yael Levy, who is the author of Chick TV. Thanks for talking with me on New Books Network.
Thank you so much, Rebecca. This was wonderful. I thank you so much for the opportunity.